you can do so on 2SER.com.
Today on The Wire.
There was just sort of like a sense of grandeur about it. Like, it just seemed just so interesting and vast.
Students look to the skies to inspire new artworks and...
Australia has made commitments to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 28% by 2030. And the electrical system is the easiest place for us to do that.
Could pumped hydro be the solution to our renewables future? Also on the show, the first ever nuclear weapons ban treaty is ratified and a child protection oversight in South Australia. Stay tuned for these stories and more on The Wire. But first, we have Aislinn Rossi here from the newsroom with what's making headlines. Hi, Aislinn.
Hi, Jess.
Puerto Rico has lost electricity after flash flooding caused by Hurricane Maria, and Dominica has been left devastated. Where's the storm headed next?
Maria is currently moving closer to Puerto Rico after already battering the coast of the US and moving down into the Caribbean. The Category 5 storm is the second largest to hit these islands this month, with many still struggling to clean up after Hurricane Irma.
And in Mexico, 231 people are now confirmed dead after a 7.1 magnitude earthquake struck close to Mexico City.
Thousands of mobile phone recordings of the chaos are flooding in online after more than 40 buildings collapsed in the nation's capital. The death toll includes at least 20 children, and a US Geological Survey says there could be up to 1,000 fatalities still to be confirmed.
Back home, One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts is the latest elected official to appear before the High Court over the citizenship crisis.
Yes, as I'm sure most know by now, the Australian Constitution bans dual citizens from being elected to public office. Now, Senator Roberts has claimed he did everything in his power to renounce his British citizenship, but the court heard today that these efforts consisted only of sending email inquiries. One to a non-existent domain and another to a decommissioned account. These hearings are ongoing, and seven other politicians will face the High Court over this issue.
And The Wire will keep track of this story as it unfolds. In New South Wales, a bill that would allow voluntary assisted dying will be introduced to the Parliament today. When is it expected to be debated?
The bill will be debated later this year and will be decided by what is expected to be a very close conscience vote. The bill was drafted by a cross-party group and includes requirements that the patient be at least 25 years old and assessed by three separate professionals. National Senator Trevor Khan told The Wire why he was involved in drafting the bill.
My own experience with my father left me profoundly affected with the way that he passed away. It was unfair and undignified for him. He wanted assistance to die, and I couldn't give it to him, and nor could my sisters. The other reason is that plainly there's been very strong community support for a bill such as this.
A similar bill is also being debated in Victoria.
And the government has today announced the route that the Melbourne to Brisbane Inland Railway will take, to some considerable backlash.
Yes, the final section of the route between Yellarbon and Gowrie will pass through the Gondamine floodplains, prompting serious safety concerns. Farmers have also expressed dissatisfaction with the route, asking the government to provide answers on how they will be compensated if their land is divided by the rail.
Thanks, Aislinn.
Enjoying the show? Tell us about it on Twitter with the hashtag TheWireRadio.
South Australia's health department has been embroiled in yet another embarrassing bungle, this time involving victims of child abuse. A number of recorded interviews with potential victims has been deemed inadmissible in court due to an oversight that did not formally accredit child protection officials to conduct them. The Wire's Denna Moore has the story.
The South Australian government is in the process of rushing retrospective laws into Parliament that will allow interviews conducted in the past 12 months to be admissible in court in order to prevent vulnerable children from having to repeat their stories. Between the 1st of July 2016 and August of this year, psychologists and social workers who had received the appropriate training were not formally accredited by then Health Minister Jack Snelling in an administrative oversight. The issue only came to light a month ago, after a court ruled one of the interviews was invalid due to the mishap. The possibility of children having to re-record their interviews or testify in court has the potential to severely re-traumatise the victims involved. Linda Franco is training and education manager at Childwise, a child abuse prevention organisation. She says these kind of failings are not isolated to South Australia.
Pre-recorded interviews are crucial in providing a therapeutic environment for children to relay their story. So they do provide some safety and security at a very difficult time for the child. A pre-recorded interview is also really important in terms of avoiding the requirement for the child to be present in say a courtroom situation. As adults, we often find those situations extremely daunting, and for children, that is more so.
If alleged victims are forced to re-record their interviews as a result of human error, such as we've seen today in South Australia, what are the potential effects that this could have on their wellbeing?
Obviously, there's a possibility that they may be potentially re-traumatised, and if there's a chance that relaying their story with regard to the abuse that they've experienced can potentially trigger other negative health and wellbeing outcomes.
What kind of processes need to be in place to ensure children are protected and mistakes like this don't happen again?
The interests of children need to be paramount. And where that is the case, we know that policy, procedures and resources can then support the efforts of people within those organisations to ensure that those best interests are met. And so I guess in terms of this particular situation, I can see that there was an error, that there was a failure perhaps to determine whether accreditation was in place. And I guess that suggests a broader issue in terms of, again, questioning the interests of children and where they're prioritised within the work of these organisations.
South Australia has had a checkered history of child protection failures. Would you have any general recommendations for authorities in the future?
All governments have had a checkered history in relation to child protection failures, and it is so important that we invest in this system, that we provide the necessary resources to protect all children. And that is an ongoing failing nationally with regard to our child protection systems, that we're not actually investing in the resources that we need to ensure that children are safe.
Linda Franco from Childwise. According to a statement provided to The Wire by South Australian Attorney General John Rau, there are currently two matters affected by this issue before the court. One decision where an interview is found to be inadmissible has been reserved, whilst the other has been adjourned pending probable amendments to the law, in the hope that victims will not have to repeat their interviews. Mr. Rao is confident that no other prosecutions will be prejudiced as a result.
The Wire's Denham Moore ending that report. More than 120 nations ratified a nuclear weapons treaty at the United Nations Assembly overnight. It is the first treaty to completely ban nuclear weapons. Judy Slatcher is the CEO of Red Cross Australia, who have been advocating the deal. The Wire's Rachel McDonald spoke to her about the treaty and what it means for the future.
After several years and many strong negotiations, about 122 countries have come together to agree on a treaty which is about prohibiting nuclear weapons. It's a really significant milestone for the world, and it's really significant that we have 122 countries stepping up to say this is what they want to achieve. The treaty is basically about prohibiting nuclear weapons, which is different to what we've had in the past, and that means prohibiting any development, production, testing, stockpiling, and of course the use or even the threat of use of nuclear weapons. But it also contains strong commitments to assisting the victims of nuclear weapons testing and also fixing up the environment where nuclear weapons testing has happened. So it's a really important treaty. It's one that I think in today's world gives hope, the hope that we need today, that we can have a future without nuclear weapons, and that 122 countries see that future.
So with over 120 nations approving this deal, who are the big players involved?
So many of the big players are ones that don't have nuclear weapons at the moment. So one of the challenges with the treaty is that those countries that do have nuclear weapons, such as the US and others, aren't currently planning to sign a treaty. But of the 122 countries, there are many, many others who are really pushing towards it. And the treaty also includes provisions for bringing on board those countries that do have nuclear weapons over time.
Considering the current tensions between North Korea and the US specifically, can you foresee a day where more dangerous countries join this agreement?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And we're very conscious that yesterday's signing ceremony was, you know, at the time when there were increasing tensions. Given the catastrophic consequences of an even limited nuclear disaster or nuclear event where, you know, whole cities can be wiped out, even with a limited event, where the killing is non-discriminate, it's not just about military targets, it's actually civilians, and where the damage continues on for generations. I was recently in Nagasaki and hearing still around 340,000 people being treated, as well as really significant intergenerational impacts of the kids of those impacted. So given the dire consequences, I think the world has to believe that there is a future without nuclear weapons, and that in fact Nagasaki was the last time nuclear weapons will be used. But it does take will and it does take commitment. And I think having 122 countries standing up in support of the treaty is an important demonstration of that.
NATO has criticised this treaty because it doesn't have the US and Russia and other big countries involved as being divisive. How would you respond to that?
From my perspective, it's all about steps along the pathway. And if the world tried to achieve things by getting everybody to sign up to everything first time, I don't think we'd achieve very much at all. But what we've seen over the decades is as you pull together large groups of countries on a common cause and they slowly, progressively come together over it, then you can achieve outcomes. And I think the Paris Accord on climate finally showed us that after a decade or so of negotiations, starting with just a few countries signing up, such as Kyoto, or quite a few countries signing up. Once that got momentum, then everybody came on board. So I think it's easy to be critical. It's harder to find the path. And I think that's what these 122 countries are doing.
What message would you have for the Australian government who've decided not to sign this?
So Australia has a really long and proud history of tackling the threat of nuclear weapons. We've been really active participants in the Non-Proliferation Treaty and also on things like the ban around eliminating testing or the impacts of testing. And so what we're hoping is that this long and proud history of being serious about tackling nuclear weapons and the threat of them, which we're very strong on, we use to now do things like sign this treaty and bring as many strengths to this cause that can be brought to it.
Judy Slatyer, CEO of Red Cross Australia, speaking with The Wire's Rachel McDonald.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Australia has the capacity to store up to 1,000 times more renewable energy than it ever could have conceivably need. That's the finding from a report released by the Australian National University today. Researchers analysed 22,000 potential pumped hydro sites across the country and found there is plenty of opportunity to supply the electricity grid with a combination of hydro, solar and wind power. Dr. Matthew Stocks is one of the researchers on this report. The Wire's Henry Wilson asked Matthew why pumped hydro is so important.
The challenge with zero emissions is that we need to change our energy mix. And at the moment, wind and PV are looking like the cheapest zero emission technologies. When we have the wind blowing and the sun shining, we're going to have lots and lots of energies. But at the time when the wind stops blowing at night, we're going to have a shortage. So we need storage in order to be able to shift the energy from times of excess to times of shortage. Pumped hydro storage is by far the most established storage technology. It's a very proven technology which has a very, very long life, and it's currently the cheapest, vastly cheaper than batteries. The challenge with Australia is we generally think about hydro as big schemes like the Snowy Scheme or what's going on in Tasmania. What's not recognised is that pumped hydro is a much smaller scale activity, and there's actually lots and lots of places where we can put a dam at the top of the hill and a dam at the bottom of the hill and store enough energy for us to be able to have a stable, reliable grid.
And how does pumped hydro work?
So the basic idea is that we have two reservoirs, one that we have at the bottom of a hill and another that we put at the top of the hill. And when we have an excess of energy, we use a pump to pump the water up the hill and store the water at the top of the hill. And when there's a shortage of energy, we let the water flow back down the hill and we generate energy just like a conventional hydro scheme.
And what determines a suitable site for pumped hydro?
So the key things that we're looking for is we need a high place as close as possible to a low place. Costs of pumped hydro are partly to do with the power generation, and that needs a pipe or a tunnel to join the two together. So we want that pipe to be as short as we possibly can. in terms of storing as much energy as we can, we want the height difference to be as much as possible. The higher you can lift an object, the more energy you can store in that. And water is a great material to store energy with because it's easy for us to move around. We've got really good pumps and we've got really good turbines for getting the energy in and out of the system.
And what other challenges are there to connecting a grid of hydro or solar and wind power to replace coal-fired electricity?
So the big challenge is understanding how the system's going to work in the future. We've had 100 years now of conventional coal and hydro generation being the main sources of electrical energy. And so we've built all the systems to work reliably and stably around that sort of planning. What we're going to do over the next decade or so is dramatically change the energy mix. And so we need to think about how that's going to behave differently and plan the system accordingly. And a lot of the old rules and ideas that we've had are no longer going to apply, and we're going to have to think about how the system works differently.
And how much of a difference do you think this will make in combating CO2 emissions and global warming?
Electricity is the easiest place for us to reduce our emissions. It is going to be vastly cheaper for us to decarbonise the electrical system than any other sector. So if you imagine going to zero carbon in transport, everyone needs to have electric vehicles driven by renewable electricity. To decarbonise household heating, everyone has to get rid of their gas heating and cooking systems. To replace cement is a real challenge. The cost of renewable energy generation is now reaching similar price points to new coal generation, and so it's going to be the cheapest way for us to reduce our emissions, and that's going to apply here in Australia and right around the world.
And how much of a positive step is this for Australia?
So the important thing here for Australia to recognise is that storage isn't going to be a problem. We don't have to invent a new technology. We don't have to invent a better battery. There's a very established technology that can deliver the stability that we're going to need and reliability that we want moving forward. And so the main thing that we're trying to get across here is that storage is not going to be a barrier for us to go to high renewables in Australia.
And is there anything else that you would like to add?
Just emphasising that Australia has made commitments to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 28% by 2030. And the electrical system is the easiest place for us to do that. There is no other sector where we can make the scale of change in the timeframe that we need. And so we need to start planning how we're going to have 100% renewable transition from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 to 70 all the way up to 100, because it's going to be the easiest place for us to reduce our emissions.
Dr. Matthew Stocks from ANU, ending that report by The Wire's Henry Wilson. Eyes are on the skies in South Australia as the State's Museum hosts a number of exhibitions looking into space. One of the exhibitions is inspired by photos taken by the Hubble telescope. The Wire's Sarah Martin reports.
The Space Our Eyes on the Sky exhibition opens on Friday 22nd September and displays five works created by students of the University of South Australia in response to images of deep space. Tim Gilchrist is the manager of temporary exhibitions at the South Australian Museum. I asked him what prompted the idea.
We started talking with the European Space Agency and their Hubble Outreach Project Officer, and overseas they've got a number of big exhibitions responding to Hubble imagery with quite large installation artworks. We didn't have the space to do that, so we came up with this concept of working with the students from the University of South Australia to put smaller 2D artworks in the windows of the South Australian Museum, paired with the Hubble Space Telescope images, which are just spectacular.
And so you provided the students with a range of images that they could then select which one they wanted to respond to?
That's right, yeah. So Hubble has put together their top 100 images, which have been released since the telescope started 27 years ago. And the students were just given the brief of, look at these images and respond to them in how you perceive our place in space. So it's a very broad brief, and they could respond in any way which could be presented on the window of the museum. So basically in a 2D format that we could reproduce digitally. And so we got this broad and wonderful mix of artworks. It was fantastic.
Tim Gilchrist, South Australian Museum. Students from the UniSA third year visual communication course each responded to a Hubble telescope image that they chose for their own reflection on space and the human endeavour to explore this uncharted territory. Five winners were chosen to exhibit as part of the Space Our Eyes on the Sky exhibition. Nicole Faiello is one of those students, and she chose to respond to the image of the Horsehead Nebula. I asked her why.
I really love the colours. I liked how the kind of forms and different shapes really matched together. It kind of looked like symmetrical, like it was just really beautiful. And I thought it was like, when you look at the other images, it kind of stood out to me because I've done kind of those colours in the past and I really liked it.
Does it sort of fascinate you that this is stuff that is out in space?
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I couldn't, yeah. Like when I saw the images, it was really hard to pick and I was just like excited and really keen.
Does it sort of make you think a little bit differently about how you approach design, like looking for that kind of inspiration?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's really important to kind of recognise other different aspects and like really look into stuff like the Hubble telescope. And like, I think you can really pick up some important things from actually like searching a bit more about it. And yeah, I think it's definitely helped me kind of realise you can base other things and put design to it.
And so talk to me about your pick.
So my piece was basically I focused on the Hubble telescope because when I researched a bit into it, I was really excited to learn a bit more about how it recognises different colours like infrared lighting and ultraviolet lighting, which is like light that we can't really see. But when the Hubble telescope picks it up, they like turn into visible lighting, which is colours that we can see. And I really enjoyed that and I thought, you know, it would be a different kind of thing to focus on when I did mine. And yeah, I just wanted to kind of focus around that and focus around my photo being something that you don't really recognise if you looked at it straight on, but then you want to kind of like explore it more and all that stuff, which I think matches and like goes in contrast with the Hubble telescope images. Like you don't understand it, but you really do want to know more about it.
Caitlin Burgess is another winner. I asked her why the challenge of this project appealed to her.
There was just sort of like a sense of grandeur about it. Like it just seemed just so interesting and vast, and there's a lot of flexibility with it. We could do what we wanted, and you don't get a lot of that in design sometimes.
When you started looking at the images and things like that, what was your first reaction to what you were looking at?
Well, it was kind of breathtaking, really. Like I couldn't believe that these were actual real photographs of like real things out in the universe. Quite amazing.
Now, you chose the Horsehead Nebula, am
yes.
I right? What made that particular image appeal to you?
It's hard to explain. It just sort of spoke to me. It just had this sort of essence of like a story behind it, and it just felt so sort of old and grand, and it was just really beautiful, and I just really connected with it.
And then when you were deciding on how to, I guess, approach interpreting that, what process did you go through?
Well, I usually go through sort of a mark-making process before starting any project, so that would be just sort of getting out some textures and paints and just sort of playing with paper and seeing what I could come up with. For this one, I chose photography, so I was able to pick that out actually quite early on with my sort of experimentation process.
And why was it for you that photography reflected what you were trying to achieve best?
It just sort of had more of a sophistication to it, and I was able to create the imagery that I wanted a lot easier with photographs as opposed to sort of traditional media.
What were you photographing?
Well, I was photographing everything. So I was sort of playing with, you know, ash clouds and dust and light, and then sort of photographing the actual world, so like trees and birds and sort of the waves and the ocean and stuff like that.
Wow, it's pretty fun to play, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I think it was probably the most fun I've had this year so far.
From the perspective of the intersection between design and science, did it make sense to you to be there?
Yeah, I think it did. It was interesting because you don't really sort of notice how much science sort of affects your daily life, and especially sort of with space technology and things I've developed from that. And so it was interesting to sort of research into that and then to also sort of look at how that sort of affects your everyday life.
When you're creating the artworks, it's more than just the making, isn't it? It's really that understanding of your content as well. You talk about research. So how much is that a part of the process for you?
It's a huge part. It's all about the intent behind the design that's important. So, you know, you need to research, you need to work out like the story you're trying to tell and why you're trying to tell it to get the best results in how it's portrayed.
And what was your reaction when you got told that you won?
I think I screamed. I actually was working all day that day and I was just so tired when I got home and I found out I won. I was just so happy. It was great.
Caitlin Burgess, one of the students who are exhibiting in the museum, Our Eyes in the Sky exhibition, which is on at the South Australian Museum from the 22nd of September to the 28th of January 2018. That's it for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again or have your say on our stories, head to our website, thewire.org.au. There you can also sign up to podcasts of the show so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search The Wire Radio, all one word. This show is a team effort by 2SER Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Jess Supple. Thanks for your company.
It's not just about people in barrels, so shut up.
What the hell?
Plenty of interesting banter to offer up right here on 2SER.
The system will defeat itself. Nothing stays in a steady state. It overheats and melts. It only feeds itself. The system, yo, I think it exists. Just because, like a pit eats its pups, eats his own litter up. The system's fucked. It's corrupt. It's for his own survival. It's genocidal. No place of origin. No beginning cycle. Let's occupy all streets. It's crazy to think in the 80s I wanted minks and the Benz to listen to Michael and Grand Poop or Maxwell and get cast while I'm sipping on drinks and Nike sweatsuits and Gucci links. I'm like a Russian mob figure. I'm mad low. In the shadows, pick up the shadow. DJ Shadow arose to throw blows. Can't see me, but Nas moving the fastest. I'm a 3D movie, no need of glasses.
I'm a 3D movie, no need of glasses.
Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Systematic. Systematic. I wish I was an arms dealer to sell legal arms in the hood. No backup check, put cash in my palms and we good. Lack of respect, get you to fall where you stood. Mathematics is God language, it's in my blood. Art, music, letters and numbers. I'm a vessel, I'm humble. Meeting startups, I invest if I want to. Transforming global markets with all of my partners. Methodical corporate culture straight out the projects. What's the ingredients to the realest? Place two cups of cranberry in the skillet. A half a cup of water, add some Henny. Let it cook for 8 minutes, but you ain't finished. Let it simmer to the cranberry, pop a little. Keep stirring, sipping his heart like Keith Heron. It gets in your blood, you start to feel what I'm feeling.
Don't listen, just try to feel what I'm feeling.
Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression. Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Close your eyes, cover your ears, do not listen. Try to feel what I'm saying. To make you feel is my new expression.
Systematic.
Systematic.